How have you been celebrating Advent? Advent's the month before Christmas. How have you been?
We have a Jesse tree.
How's it going?
A Jesse tree. What's a Jesse tree? Well, I don't care what you were doing, because I have enjoyed this candle. No, I do care. But, yeah, keep going.
No, that's where
we're
looking
at the candle. Okay. Jesse trees I've never heard of, so that's really cool. Cooler than my candle, no doubt. Actually, it's Anita's. But I've become attached to it, and I need a little, like, something to put it on here. Yeah, sorry. Ah, yes. All right. Fire regulations, you think? Maybe. Could be. Right, I've also been listening to Handel's Messiah, and who's heard Handel's Messiah? It's millions of people every year listen to Handel's Messiah at Advent time. There is something happening, I think, tonight in Sydney Town Hall. There's an orchestra and 300 strong choir. So that's pretty exciting. Someone told me this morning they used to go every year when it was the Opera House. Hey?
Free.
I don't know if it's free or...
No.
No, it's not free.
Volunteer to sing.
But apparently... Yeah, you volunteer to sing, so that's why it's 300. So it's whoever volunteers. They've got to prove they can sing, but yeah, it's a pretty cool idea. And so Handel's Messiah is an oratorio, yes, written 1741 by George Frederick Handel, and it's just absolutely mesmerizing from the moment the tenor starts singing "Comfort, comfort my people," and then verse, after chorus, cascading through this incredible presentation of the prophecies of the Messiah from the book of Isaiah and showing how they're fulfilled by Jesus in the Gospels. It is an absolutely glorious piece of music, culminating in the Hallelujah chorus, which has to be the best, or most glorious at least, piece of music ever written. So at the end I want to play to you from Handel's Messiah, "Unto Us a Child is Born," which is a passage from what we just read in Isaiah 9, verses 6 and 7. Isaiah 9 comes before the prophecies we looked at this year from the book of Isaiah, if you remember, the suffering servant songs. Well, this comes before that, but it's part of those prophecies of the Messiah that Isaiah wrote more than 700 years before Jesus. Verse 6, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given." It's a promise that a son of David will come and he will rule forever and he will deliver his people. So firstly, let's look at the context of this prophecy and then the content, and then we'll listen to "Unto Us a Child is Born." The context, Isaiah says, is darkness. It's darkness. Chapter 9, verse 2 says, "The people are walking in darkness and dwell in deep darkness." What a great description of even the world today. And the darkness that Isaiah is talking about is the immediate situation of Assyria, the superpower of the day, to the north. Assyria will be the unwitting instrument of God's judgment on Israel. Isaiah tells us in chapter 8, verse 7, "The king of Assyria will be like the Euphrates River in flood, breaking its banks and sweeping across the land of Israel." Absolutely terrifying. And so this is a political darkness that is casting a shadow over the people of Israel. But it's happening because of a spiritual darkness in Israel. Because of, back in chapter 7, Isaiah anchors what's happening in the days of Ahaz, the king of Judah. And King Judah is the southern part of Israel. So here is Ahaz ruling on David's throne, but Ahaz sacrificed his two sons to pagan gods, even though he was a descendant of King David. And he had no desire whatsoever to include God in the affairs of a nation. And the northern kingdom of Israel formed an alliance with Syria, based around Damascus, to try and secure their future with the threat of Assyria coming down. And they sent word to Ahaz in Judah, join us in this alliance against Assyria, or we'll attack you. And Ahaz says, no way. So the northern kingdom of Israel attacks the southern kingdom. 120,000 Jews fall that day. But Jerusalem stands, and God says to Ahaz, I know your problem to the north, but I will protect you. But Ahaz, instead of listening to God, tries to make an alliance with Assyria. And crazy, right? But God says, listen, you don't need Assyria. I will protect you, and I'll give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel, God with us. How good is that? Well, Ahaz ignores that and does join with Assyria. Assyria helps Judah for a bit, but then ultimately is terrible. And in chapter 8, Isaiah announces the Assyrian invasion of Israel, which brings us to chapter 8, verse 22. They will see only distress, darkness, and fearful gloom, and they will be thrust into utter darkness. So all that's the backdrop to the prophecy in chapter 9. That's not a very encouraging story, is it? And probably some of you are saying, can we please get to chapter 9, verse 6 and 7, because that's the good stuff. But we can't really understand the good stuff unless we first understood the bad stuff. So this is a nation walking in darkness. And Isaiah picks up his pen and in chapter 9, verse 1 says, nevertheless, love that, nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. Zebulun and Naphtali are regions to the north of the northern kingdom of Israel, and he calls it Galilee of the Nations, which probably refers to the fact that Assyria had already invaded. And so it's to these people, specifically those who are in the northern part of the northern kingdom, that Isaiah says, you will see a great light. And in the days of Jesus, as he sets up his base camp in Capernaum, which is in Naphtali by the Sea of Galilee, Matthew says, Isaiah is fulfilled. Jesus is the great light that will dawn. And so the people who were the very first to encounter the darkness as Assyria swept down over Israel, they will be the first to see the light of the Messiah when he comes. And Isaiah says, it is time to rejoice because God will deliver you. Verse 5, there'll be no more war. The yoke of oppression that's across your shoulders will be broken. And then verse 6, he says, this is going to happen through a child. It's going to be through a child. For to us a child is born. And when this child comes, the anguish, the gloom, the distress, and the darkness will all disappear. And this child will fulfill all the hopes of Israel. And when history is at its darkest, God's grace will shine the brightest. And so there's every reason to rejoice. So that sort of sets the table ready for the meal that we're now going to be served, which is the prophecy in verses 6 and 7. To us, a child is born. To us, a son is given. And the government will be upon his shoulders. He will rule. And he has this incredible five-part name. What's in a name? Remember, Juliet was in love with Romeo, and she discovered that Romeo was a Montague, and she was a Capulet, and so they couldn't be married. What's in a name? What's really in a name? Well, according to Isaiah, there's a whole lot in a name. And back in chapter 8, Isaiah says his own name, Isaiah, means God is salvation. And in chapter 7, the name of the child who will be born of a virgin is Emmanuel, which means God with us. In other words, the names that are given tell us what God will do for Israel. And there are other names that are given. So names are very, very important in Isaiah 7, 8 and 9, those three chapters. And so when we come to this name now, in chapter 9, verse 6, it's vital that we understand it, because all these titles are attributed to one person. His name's singular, and there are five different descriptions. His name is a pentad of titles, and all of them describe the one who has a name that is above every other name. And Paul says that at his name every knee will bow, and there is no other name under heaven by which people will be saved. Author Dietrich Bonhoeffer says every title here comes from unfathomable depths, and taken together they try to encompass one single name, and that name is Jesus. Now, we don't have time to plumb the depths of each title, but let's look quickly at them. It begins with the name Wonderful, which is a noun in the Hebrew and may be meant as a title in its own right. And when you think about it, isn't that a great title for Jesus? Wonderful. It's a bit quaint, but there's no better name for Jesus, is there, than the name Wonderful. He's wonderful. I remember my mother, when I was very little, taught me a song. The lyric was basically, "Isn't he wonderful, wonderful, wonderful," which she then repeated again and again. And I remember drawing the W of the wonderful in a very big W. And I remember drawing that and just being so captured by this idea. I think partly because my mother, I knew she knew how wonderful he is. And as she sang me the song, I knew she got it. And it really stayed with me, and I remember that song more than I remember any other song that my mother taught me. Isn't he wonderful? And his name here is Wonderful. And the great preacher Spurgeon says, "They that know him best will say that that word, wonderful, does not overstrain his merits, but rather falls infinitely short of his glorious deserving." Wonderful. And this is amazing, because this name occurs in Judges 13, when a guy named Manoah is told that he'll have a son who turns out to be Samson. And he says to the angel of the Lord, who we know is God, it's an appearance of God, he says to this angel, "What's your name?" And the angel responds, "Why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?" In other words, my name, my character, my being are beyond human description. It's wonderful. Human words can never do justice to my name. So really, the name Wonderful suggests divinity, that this is God, who is beyond what our words can describe. And what's clear from these verses is that this child is God. We're told that this child, who is Emmanuel in chapter 7, God with us, is on the one hand completely human, yet at the same time he is God. Because if you look at the other titles, he's Mighty God and Everlasting Father, yet he's a child, yet he's born. So this is teaching us 700 years plus before Jesus was born, this is teaching us about the incarnation, that Jesus Christ is fully God and fully man. That this child is on the one hand the everlasting Father with no beginning or end, and yet on the other hand he's a child, he was born. And these two natures, his divinity and his humanity, mysteriously and gloriously are united in this little child. So what happened in Bethlehem when he was born was that the eternal, pre-existing God the Son took on flesh and became a human being. And it's wonderful. I mean, if we could just wrap our minds around what that means. Fully God and fully man. God became a child. This is why Christmas carols are so good. Christ, by highest heaven adored. Christ, the everlasting Lord. Late in time, behold him come, offspring of a virgin's womb. Veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail the incarnate deity. Pleased with man, as man, to dwell. Jesus, our Emmanuel. And Isaiah is inviting us to wonder. His name is Wonderful. And wonder involves both reverence and joy. Bonhoeffer says, in this Jesus, child of Mary, dwells Almighty God. Just take that in for a moment. Just sit before that statement. Let's be quiet in reverence. Before that simple statement, God became a child. I love this painting, the reverence and joy of the shepherds as they look at the baby Jesus. Sometimes we don't take the time. We're so busy, but we need to sit quietly, particularly at this time of year, and contemplate the mystery, the wonder of what is being said. He is wonderful in his eternity, in his humanity, in his divinity. He's wonderful. And he's counselor, which relates to his kingship. That's what kings do. They give counsel. And Paul says, in Jesus are hidden all the riches of God's wisdom and knowledge. He has the mind of God. He's a wonderful counselor. He has the answer to all our problems. He has all the wisdom we need. He has all the wisdom that he needs to rule the universe as the king. And he's offering that to us. He's our king. Unto us a child is born. Unto us a son is given. He's given to us as our counselor. The one we can go to for counseling, for help, for guidance. He has all the wisdom that we need in our complicated, messy lives with all the challenges that we face. He is there as our counselor. Come to him. And ask him, this is what prayer is. Ask him for what you need to know and for wisdom. He has all the wisdom you would ever need. He's wonderful. He's a wonderful counselor and he's mighty God. Again, this relates, I think, to his kingship. He will rule with the power and the authority of God because he is God. And we see Jesus beginning in Bethlehem in weakness, coming as a baby. But as he begins to teach, oh, the authority, the power that he has in his person. The disciples say, even the wind and the waves obey him. Demons immediately obey him. He has all the power and authority of God. He is wonderful. In his authority. And again, he's our king. He has that authority, that power for us, on our behalf. Again, that's what prayer is, to come to him. He is ready to give us the power we need, or to act in power on our behalf, ultimately to save us, to bring us into the new creation, to raise us from the dead. That is wonderful power that he has for us as our king given to us. He's wonderful. He's our counselor. He's mighty God and he's everlasting Father. Again, I think this relates to his kingship, that as a king, he will rule in a fatherly way. His concern will be for the helpless, the poor, the oppressed, the fatherless. This is a huge theme as we go through Isaiah. That this Messiah who will come will suffer for us, will set free the prisoner, who will bind up the brokenhearted. The pattern of his kingship is the pattern of fatherhood. In other words, gentle concern to discipline and to help and to care for his children. And as Isaiah 42 puts it, a bruised reed he will not break. Fifthly, he is the Prince of Peace. He is peace. He's the embodiment of peace. He's the Prince of Peace. And he gives peace. Verse 5, there'll be no more war. So there's going to be harmony under his kingship. And more than that, peace means favour with God. The angels say at Jesus' birth, peace on earth, and may God's favour rest on mankind. He will bring the peace of God and peace with God to the world. And verse 7, of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. His rule will increase and increase and increase, and so that his rule will fill the universe. And as his rule increases, peace will increase. Peace will expand. Peace will enter every sphere of the creation under his rule. The world today believes that the way to peace is tolerance, but true peace requires more than a commitment to tolerate each other. True peace requires someone or something to unite humanity. Something we can all get behind. Someone who can heal us. Someone who can lead us. And there's simply nothing big enough, comprehensive enough, powerful enough in this world to unite this world. No political platform, no scientific breakthrough, no business plan. None of those things are big enough to unite humanity. The only thing that can unite us is Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And he can meet all of our longings, our desires, and our hopes. He is the Prince of Peace. And the focal point of his kingdom is David's throne, because he's the Son of David. He's the Messiah. He'll uphold justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. No corruption, no abuse of power, only peace. And this will definitely happen, for the Lord's zeal will accomplish this. His love, his zeal for his people will accomplish this. Because in a moment in time, he promised to his beloved, David, that there would be a king on David's throne who would rule forever. So his zeal for his son David and his promise to his people cannot be nullified. Even by Ahaz, the corrupt king, even by the corruption of Israel at the time, he will not forget his promise to David. His zeal for his people, and particularly for David, mean that he will keep his word. And so this passage ultimately is about how God will not let go of his people. He's zealous to keep his word, his promise. And there will be a king on David's throne who will rule forever and bring peace to the whole world. That will happen. The zeal of the Lord guarantees it. And he is wonderful. He's our king, the one who we can go to for counsel. All the wisdom of God is with him. All the power of God resides in him. And that power is there to be used on our behalf as his people. And he rules with fatherly care. A bruised reed he will not break. A smouldering wick he will not snuff out. And he brings peace. He brings peace to every space in this universe. So let's hear this sung. Let's hear Handel. He's clearly inspired. Let's just sit before this in awe about what we're being told. This is the London Symphony Orchestra. I love the joy on their faces. I love the cascading verse and responses and all the different parts. Can we just sit before this and allow joy and wonder to emerge in our hearts? Thank you.
Thank you.